You know, if it wasn't for mining, Wisconsin never would have been the Badger State. The University of Wisconsin-Madison would have needed a different mascot. Don't know exactly what that might have been. But it's worthwhile then to take some time today to talk about the history of mining in Wisconsin here on the Lee Rayburn Show. And our guest to do that is a senior lecturer emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville. If you have questions about the history of mining in Wisconsin or a story of your own that ties back to the legacy of mining in Wisconsin, you are welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email anytime to talk@wpr.org. Our guest joining us now is Tracy Lee Roberts, and Tracy, welcome back.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a little bit of geology, shall we? What was it about the Driftless region that made it so rich for mining?
Well, you know, the word driftless really means that we're in an area down here in the lead mine district that is lacking glacial drift. That's the heavy rocks, the soil, you know, the gravel, the sand that glaciers pushed and crushed as they were moving southward. So our area was missed, which means we didn't end up under feet and feet, maybe even a mile of drift material. That means the lead that was percolating up from the, you know, bowels of the earth 360 million years ago was actually closer to the surface because we didn't have the drift on top. Made it easier to find that lead ore.
That makes a lot of sense. Before we get to the European settlers who made this the Badger State, what's this history of Native Americans and mining in the Driftless region?
Well, Native Americans were mining here way before white people showed up in the area. We have found, you know, I haven't found, but archaeologists all over the country have found that there is our kind of lead ore all over the country in Native American sites. So, for example, in Hopewell sites in Ohio, we find our type of lead ore there. So there is clearly a lot of trading going on. You know, lead is often crystallized, and it's in kind of crystal shapes, and it's often combined with some silver, making it very shiny. So it's a really interesting kind of ore, which was prized by lots of people.
And then, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, and then we would have seen... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that... So we're talking about, you know, very ancient pre-contact Native Americans, and Ho-Chunk people in our state say that they have been here forever, like they've been here since, you know, the last Pleistocene. So, you know, they've been here thousands of years. So they feel that they are the descendants of those miners.
Sure. And I think what fascinates me is how far our lead could be found in Native tribes across this country.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So when it comes to the European settlers then, who were they? What, you know, who were these incoming lead miners? Where did they come from? And how did they land on these mines as a resource?
Sure. Well, you know, we had this, on this continent, there was this huge rivalry between the French, the British, and the Spanish. You know, and we're talking about way, you know, early 1500s. So you've got 1600s. You're talking about major rivalries between colonial powers. So the French, of course, had gone up into Canada. And, of course, you know, the British were along the eastern seaboard, and the Spanish had come up from the south, and they were inhabiting all kinds of areas around the Mississippi River and into the south. And they weren't holding down the fort real well, but the French certainly were in Canada. And so they started coming down into different areas and making maps. We know about Louis Joliet, Joliet, and Father Jacques Marquette. When they came around this area, and I'm talking about my area, the lead mine district in southwest Wisconsin, in 1672, they made a map called the Map of New Discoveries. And this map clearly shows the word, like, mine de plume, which in, you know, means mines of lead. So they were quite aware of this lead. So different French people were starting to explore the area. But it was really when Julien Dubuque showed up from Canada, he established the village of Dubuque, Iowa. But he was working with the Native Americans. He wasn't working against them. He worked with Métis cultures, which were combinations of French and Native American people. And they were mostly Meskaki, Sauk, and Menominee, and some Ho-Chunk. But mostly the Meskaki were working with him. So that was at where Dubuque, Iowa stands today. And that was in the late 1700s. So you can see the long progression of people discovering, exploring, and learning about these mines and being excited about it. But Dubuque really being able to make that connection where he made friends with these folks and intermarried with the Meskaki people and therefore made the connections needed to create a lead mining camp there.
Tracy, what was the lead mining process like? How did they extract ore? How did they dig? What kind of tools were they using? Did they have furnaces to smelt with?
So we're using like picks and gads at first and then just basic simple tools. So they're digging a hole. They're digging down maybe 6 to 8 feet, something safe where you're not having to, you know, build up the walls too much, where you won't have to worry about a cave-in, seeing if there's any lead ore. And if there is, they're going to follow that on the horizontal. So you're going down vertically, and then you're going to go check if that vein of lead is running, you know, horizontally along a certain at a certain elevation. If they find that lead, they're going to keep digging, and they're going to start propping up the sides. And as more technology comes into the area, they're able to start, you know, getting the water out of mines that are deeper. Mm-hmm. So technology plays a huge role here. In terms of smelting lead ore, Native Americans had smelting, but it was a little more crude and didn't create the product that made for a very malleable lead. It didn't drive off enough of the sulfur molecules and the other things that can be in lead that make it brittle. So it was when the lead furnaces of the 1840s came in, the blast furnace, that really the lead ore was much better quality in that point.
Tracy Lee Roberts, our guest, Senior Lecturer Emeritus from the History Department at UW-Platteville, taking a look at the Lead District and the mining history of the Badger State. And if you have a question or a story to share, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You talk about the French explorers making their way down from Canada, but I am certain, Tracy, that there are many nationalities that ended up becoming who we call today as the Badgers and some of the miners in the Driftless region.
Yes, absolutely. So as soon as Americans are hearing about all this lead ore coming out of the area, they're pretty excited about it and start moving toward the area. Well, Native Americans controlled this whole region, so it wasn't like nobody was here.
Right.
And they were adamant that they were going to keep their mines. The mines that Dubuque started with these Native American groups, once he died in 1810, they weren't going to let go of that. They never gave Dubuque that land. They did a lease with him. Other white people said, no, Dubuque owned the land, so I'm a descendant, or he owes me money, so I get to own the land now. And they're like, no, that's not true, and if you come into our land, we will kill you. So there were lots of skirmishes between 1810 and 1821 to keep out white miners. But finally, actually, it was Southerners who came first before the immigration of folks from Europe. So we're talking about some really powerful Americans, like Colonel Richard M. Johnson became Vice President of the United States not too much later. He was supposedly the killer of Tecumseh at the Battle of Thames. That was, I think, 1813. And he and his brother showed up in the lead mine district, but they showed up with military troops, U.S. troops, on horseback. So now the Native Americans are like, oh, oops, maybe we can't hold on to this. And sure enough, he bought a very important major mine that was actually in the Galena, Illinois area for only $300. And the thing produced unbelievable amounts of lead ore. So it was mostly those folks. So, we talk about the Southerners coming up from Southern Illinois, Missouri, Kentucky area. Then we talk about how folks showed up from the East Coast. So we've got these Yankees showing up with a very different view on how things should be done. And then, of course, we have our immigrant population. So maybe you'd be interested in talking about that at this point.
Yeah, because Tracy, the Yankees and the Southerners, I guess I did not know. I always thought of it as sort of an opportunity for immigrants to America who made their way all the way into the heartland. And this is what they found as their best bet to eke out a living, to carve out a little piece for themselves, quite literally when it comes to the caves that they would sleep in. But I didn't know about the Southerners that came up and then claimed the mines and brought, you know, a small army with them, and what kind of resources they must have had to come up here and take this land.
Well, some of them had some resources in terms of knowing how to mine lead ore, because in Missouri there was a big lead mining industry, and it really was bigger than the industry we have in Wisconsin for a while. It's just that their industry was about 50 miles from the Mississippi River, making it hard to transport the lead, the finished lead ore, to a way to get it down to St. Louis, down to, down to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So Galena, Illinois, became the port town of the lead mine district of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin River was as well. And so these are places that are much closer to the Mississippi River, making it cheaper and easier to move really heavy ore overland. But these folks, these Yankees and Southerners, had, you know, names for each other. I mean, even the Southerners, like, they called the Southern Illinois folks suckers because, like, the sucker fish, right? They would show up in the summer and they'd leave in the winter. They're only there for a couple months of the year. And they do a little mining, and then they go back to their farm and their homes, you know, south. So they all had names. And the badger name, you seem interested in that, and I want to just talk about that for a minute.
Sure.
If I could. I did a big study on a thing called badger huts, and I had that article published in the Illinois Journal called Illinois Heritage Magazine, and that was a publication of Illinois State Historical Society. And badger huts are actually not just caves, but they're actually built from limestone. They still are on the landscape. So I went around this whole region, and I found as many badger huts as I could. I found 12 still standing.
Huh.
And the documentary evidence is quite clear that they were building these huts into hillocks, or creating kind of a hillock by mounding up dirt and then building down and into to make a cavity that they would have an arched building, and this building would be about 12 feet deep and about 8 feet wide and about 7 feet high at the apex of the building. And these are lovely, lovely little buildings. And they are all over our region, from Galena into Lafayette County, Grant County. I have found a number of these. And so I found this fascinating because I first read about it in the historic documentation about the area, that there were these buildings. I'm like, well, are they still out there?
Yeah.
Well, yes, they are. They still are out there. So that's kind of fun. And that's how we got to be called the Badger State. It wasn't so much that they were only they weren't exactly digging into a hole. I mean,
no.
There was a little bit of that. But there were also these badger huts, which were not too bad, and they've been standing for 200 years now.
I was going to say, they're right around the size of some of the one bedrooms you'll find on campus at the UW schools.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I mean, their footprint wasn't that much bigger than some of the log cabins that were in the area.
Let's go to Stan and DePere, who's got a question for you, Tracy. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi. We understand today that lead can be a possibly dangerous element, and I'm wondering if the early miners and the Native Americans were afflicted with lead poisoning, and what that looked like.
Ooh.
Right. That's a good question. Yes, all mining, all extractive economies cause ecological damage and hurt animals, plants, and people. They do. So the problem with the mining, of course, is you're not just bringing up lead ore. You're also bringing up cadmium, and you're bringing up all kinds of arsenic. You're bringing up toxic metals because that's what's in the deeper ground, right? Not maybe on our surface ground very much, but in the deeper ground. So you are bringing up things. The smelting process itself in the 1800s, basically that process was you had a furnace and you were using a blast furnace. You're getting that furnace to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit at least. That's going to release the sulfur dioxide and the nitrogen oxide molecules, and those get reactive with oxygen and water vapors once they're in the atmosphere up through the chimney. That creates sulfuric acid,
Ooh.
Nitric acid. That's called acid rain. That harms the soil. It creates a very acidic soil. It harms the plants, the animals. The lead itself, like if you were just touching lead, or like we have these at our museums in the area, and they let children and other people touch the lead ore in its sort of state of being in the matrix of the limestone, that's not very dangerous. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to lick your hand afterwards, right? But it's really when the lead is being crushed and when it's being processed and all that dust and stuff comes up into your lungs, now you're getting lead poisoning into your lungs, and it made people irritable. It made them slower and dopey over time. You know, it definitely had a bad effect. Yes.
Thank you for the call, Stan. Tracy, what happened to the lead mines of the Driftless region? Did we just run out of lead? What was the inevitable outcome?
We ran out of the easy lead, I'd say that. Most people will say that there's still a lot of lead under the ground, but it's not economically feasible to take it out. Same with zinc. Other countries are taking their lead out much cheaper, and these are international commodities. These aren't just local things that we need in our country. Lead right now is mostly used in car batteries. We've tried to get it as much out of the environment, as you know. It's not in our gasoline or our paint anymore, thank goodness. But, you know, we are using it for batteries and other things, and it's used, you know, internationally. So it went away because of economics. It was no longer, it didn't pay to do it. Also, the easy ore was taken, so it gets more expensive when you have to go deeper underground, and now you've got a water table problem. So how are you going to get the water out? Well, now you need a steam engine, and then you need all kinds of other equipment to get it out. So it's no longer an easy two-man process with, you know, a windlass and a bucket and picking a gad, which is all you needed in the early days.
So when did that lead mining industry slow down or close?
By 1865, it was definitely slowed down. There was a peak during the Civil War, but then, you know, right after that war, you know, lead's used for making shot bullets. You know, lead ore was used for joining and seaming metal to stone or metal to metal. So when the Spanish actually, it's an international commodity, they started being able to produce it more cheaply, and ours wasn't as easy to get to. So it was kind of a lull in mining, and everybody went to farming if they hadn't already done that. And then our zinc mining started building up. Zinc is often found with lead ore. So the zinc is usually deeper, though. So it takes more equipment, more expensive equipment, and much more processing, very complicated processing methods to get the zinc. You know, we use zinc for, like, galvanizing, right? For
sure.
Iron, steel, and it prevents rust. And it was used to make white paint, you know, like zinc oxide. So, you know, these industries died for an economic reason. And then by 1979, we finally have an EPA saying, you are, you know, adding a lot of toxins to the environment. We need to clean this up. And we do have a couple of Superfund sites that are related to mining in our area.
So the zinc mining followed the lead mining in the Driftless region. Were there folks who made millions off this? Were there mining magnates from this area?
Well, mostly, you know, by the time 1860s comes around, if you look at, like, plat maps, most of the land by that time was owned, the lead mining land and later zinc mining land was owned by large corporate interests. It wasn't like a couple of guys with a mining lease anymore. My family came here in 1834 as lead miners. So I got really interested in this topic, you know, as a historian, because I had a personal connection to the lead mine district and to this industry. So I got you know, much more interested than I might have been. But I think that the mining was the thing that made the boom of this part of Wisconsin. I mean, we were the most populated area of Wisconsin when Wisconsin became a state. You know, the population was really down here. And, of course, over by Green Bay in the east. But, you know, the rest of the state wasn't that well populated yet.
And I'd imagine part of that has to do with river travel, lake travel up in Green Bay, and the ability to get around before we had roads. But I also wonder, you know, where can I find these badger dens today? If I wanted to go see these, and are they protected lands?
So all of them are on private land.
Oh.
But I don't know if this is okay to tell you that I'm giving a tour of Native American Lead Mine District.
Yes.
On Sunday, September 27th. And we're going to start from Galena at 9:45. We're going to get on an air-conditioned bus. There's room for 40 people, and I still have seats. And I'm doing this with the Galena Joe Davis County Historical Society. So if people want to go to galenahistory.org, they can find the bus tour and join us. We're going to go by a badger hut, besides seeing a whole bunch of other sites related to Native Americans, the mining culture, and the actual mining industry in the area. So it should be a fun tour. It's a five-hour tour.
Sunday, September 27th, through the Galena Historical Society, online at galenahistory.org?
That's correct.
I like that you threw AC in there, Tracy. That is always...
I know. After this summer, who knows? September could be hot again.
Exactly. Tracy Lee Roberts, yeah. What are you still curious about in this story of Wisconsin's history? What are you still researching and looking to find out more?
Well, you know, I had to learn about the lead mining industry itself so that I could talk about it as the basis, but I'm actually more a social historian. I'm really interested in the abolitionists that were here. I'm really interested in cultural history and the ethnic groups that came. My family came from Northern England. That's a lead mining district. They came with unbelievable skills. They were already miners in England. And we talk about these Cornish miners. They were already highly skilled miners. So they're not just the Southern guy showing up for 3 months as a sucker and then going back down, you know, and just using a pick and a gad. These guys had some different kinds of skills that were more technologically advanced. So by the 1840s, we're getting these immigrant miners who really know what they're doing.
And then do we still see legacies of that today? Are there still institutions or organizations? Is there still a place where we will find this history existing now?
I'd say in every single town in the lead mine district, we're seeing the evidence of the early ethnic groups that came here. We have their churches. We have their buildings. We have their institutions, their cultural institutions. The Primitive Methodist Church is a really important British institution that came here from England and really made a big splash in this area. It's one of the biggest rural church groups in the area. It's very small now, but still mighty. And, you know, Catholic churches, Father Mazzucchelli, one of our great leaders in this area, came from Italy, and he was an early 1830s Catholic priest here that made a huge difference. He was also an architect. He built buildings. He's created institutions, girls' schools, so that girls could learn science in the 1850s.
I mean,
so we have these folks who just helped us create communities, and the Irish tended to stick together. So we've got Irish old communities. We've got, you know, old British communities. They're still called places like Irish Hollow, British Hollow. You know, these places exist in our area.
Tracy Lee Roberts, I find that fascinating. Of all the fascinating things you've shared here this half hour, looking at what we see in the Driftless today and being able to see all the way back in time to our mining history, fascinating, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Sure, it was fun. Thank you so much.
Again, that tour with Tracy Lee Roberts is Sunday, September 27th through the Galena Historical Society. Tracy Lee Roberts is a senior lecturer emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.